is Love Your Work. On this show, we help you make it as a creative. I'm David Cadavy. If you want to join us here on Love Your Work every Thursday, please hit subscribe on your podcast app. And please sign up for the Love Mondays newsletter. I've studied history's greatest creatives, and each Monday I share with you the very best lessons I've learned along the way. It's 2 minutes a week. It's free. Sign up at cadavy.net/Mondays. On July 4th of this year, I was finally hitting my stride. After a year of visa troubles, I had secured a 3-year visa. I was finally back in the rhythm I had been in before all my visa troubles started. Things had been fucked, and they had become unfucked. Little did I know, everything was about to get even more fucked than it was before. One thing that got me through the fuckness that ensued, you'll hear about it in this conversation, was that I had read Everything is Fucked by Mark Manson. Sorry for all the cussing, that's the title of the book. In this conversation, you'll learn how can a book called Everything is Fucked possibly be, as the subtitle promises, a book about hope. Everything being fucked doesn't require hope. Hope requires everything to be fucked. Also, I've talked before on the show about living an anti-fragile life. Learn how to avoid having what Mark calls fragile values. And finally, Mark says, if there's no reason to live, then there's no reason to not live. How can what Mark calls the uncomfortable truth, this idea that life is meaningless, that everybody that we know, and including ourselves, are going to die, how can that be liberating instead of deflating? Before we get to that, I have a listener showcase for you. This week's listener is Paula Schmidt. Paula has a new book, Solo, Survival Guide for Creative Freelancers. It's for people who believe in creative living on their own terms, mixing freelance work with creating and selling their own art. Solo promises to help you set realistic and actionable goals to carve out your path. Paula is giving it away to listeners for a limited time. Check it out at bit.ly/Cadavy. That's bit.ly/Cadavy. And that's very cool that he made a URL just for sharing on the show here. By the way, I would love to feature you on the listener showcase. There's a really short form to fill out. It is available at cadavy.net/showcase. Now, one thing I love is on the box where it talks about the features that it doesn't have. Most definitely does not have Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, video streaming, dial-up, email, social media. Last week, you heard about the Awake Mindfulness Clock and some of the features this meditation timer / alarm clock doesn't have. Later in this episode, you'll hear about some of the cool features it does have. Remember, you can get 10% off the Awake Mindfulness Clock when you use the code LOVEYOURWORK at offgridmindfulness.com. If you purchase by December 16th, you'll get a free travel case. Here is Mark Manson. I'm here with Mark Manson, and Mark's new book is Everything is Fucked, which is great. It came at the perfect time for me because everything was so fucked in my life that a lot of my listeners know about. and then it became kind of unfucked. And this book kind of helped me process what helped me get through that. And then things became like way more fucked than they had ever been before, which my listeners might know about by now. And we might be able to get into it. But this is a book about hope, right? And so it's a book that when everything is fucked, it can help you find hope. So how can a book that's called Everything is Fucked be a book about hope?
I think it kind of has to be. I mean, one of the things I love about the title and just kind of playing around with the title and the concepts is that on its surface, it seems like a paradox. But once you get further into the book, you realize that to be able to have hope for the future, you have to perceive some sort of problem or crisis in the present. And so there's actually this idea of things being fucked and there being hope for something better. They're actually very symbiotic. Like they need each other. You can't, if everything is great all the time, then you actually start to become hopeless because there's nothing to look forward to.
Right.
And so it's a lot of the first half of the book is kind of just turning some of these ideas on their head. A lot of our assumptions about these things on their head.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, the way that things got really, really fucked was, first of all, I was having visa troubles for a year. And then as soon as that cleared up, I had to make an emergency trip out of Colombia again because my mom was in a coma and she ended up dying. And
oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was the most horrible thing. It was just as horrible as you could imagine it. But at the same time, I was kind of like, I'm still kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop in terms of processing it. Like it was obviously very difficult, but I'm surprised that I'm still able to function and things are okay. Part of it was, I think I was able to find some meaning in the fuckness of it all. You know, like you're a writer. I've heard you say that writing is this sort of form of therapy for you. And so I'm the same way. And so like the whole time this thing is happening, I'm like writing these little vignettes of just what I can remember. And I'm in this blur of this really terrible thing. And as I'm doing it, I'm like, well, I'm curious about what I'm going to learn from this experience. I'm curious about how it's going to change me. I'm curious about like, wow, look at how terrible this is. And I'm living it. And there's something exciting about that. I found myself thinking those things.
Yeah.
And I don't know, does any of that track with your understanding of hope coming from things being fucked?
I think so. I think what you're bringing up is something that you don't hear mentioned very often, but I definitely think is true, is that often catastrophe has a certain excitement to it.
Yeah.
And it's not an excitement that's desirable, but I think it's an excitement. Like you often hear military veterans or like war veterans talk about this, about how being on the battlefield is actually sometimes it's euphoric. And because you never have felt more alive than when you're that close to death.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I wrote about a close friend of mine dying at the end of Subtle Art. And that's really kind of my only experience grieving as an adult. There were some deaths in my family as a child, but I remember there was something kind of, I don't even know if there's a word for it. I don't know. I think that the only way I can think of how to put it is that feeling of like, I'm alive. Like this matters. This moment matters. Mm-hmm. The way I choose to proceed from this moment matters. And I think one of the arguments I make in the new book is that because of how much, just how connected we are with the world. I think one of the side effects of how connected we are at this present moment is that it is that sense of mattering, is that sense of like this decision, this experience at this moment is important and it's going to make a difference. I think it's becoming harder to attain that. And so when you experience a tragedy like you did, with all the grief and the depression and sadness and pain, mixed into that is this like very profound sense of meaning and an opportunity. And it's a weird thing for sure. But it's to get kind of back to what I was saying about the play on words in the title, like one of the themes that I consistently harp on throughout my work is that all of these experiences are multifaceted and they're complex. They often have two sides to them. You know, it's often our the biggest pains in our life are often the most formative and important experiences that we have, and often the most exciting and fun things that we do are often the things that we come to regret or feel ashamed about. And so it's nothing is ever as simple as like, you know, hey, I'm happy, you know, or hey, I'm sad. It's there's this whole existential question of meaning that that is happening on a higher level that is very difficult to tap into and talk about. And I very much in my writing try to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. And I think that at the base of it is this idea of the uncomfortable truth, which you talk about in And Everything is Fucked. So I think that it is one day you and everyone you love will die, and beyond a small group of people for an extremely brief period of time, little of what you say or do will ever matter. Now, how can anybody find any hope in a statement like that, right? That's kind of what I think a lot of people's reaction is to that. I feel a good relationship with the uncomfortable truth. Like I try to remind myself of that every single day.
Yeah.
So how does somebody arrive at the point where they're okay with the uncomfortable truth, as uncomfortable as it is?
You know, my argument in the book is that most, and it's not something I came up with, it actually comes from Ernest Becker, but it's the argument is that most of what motivates us throughout our lives is really just kind of an elaborate avoidance of this fact that we're going to die, and most of what we do is going to be insignificant,
right,
and meaningless. And that's terrifying, you know? And so we cover that up with all sorts of, well, no, this quarter's bonus is really, really important. I swear, this matters. This fucking matters. I promise. You know, and like we kind of invent all these narratives and stories for ourselves that we buy into.
Or like a religion, right? Like a religion might give you some protection from that uncomfortable truth. Is that kind of the purpose of that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. You know, this whole idea of, you know, that we're all special and that we're all, you know, we all have a soul that is immortal and carries on after we die. Like these are all kind of beliefs that buttress us against this, what is really just a fundamental, it's just reality. It's that we are so insignificant in the grand scheme of things. And so my argument is that, you know, so much of our work throughout our lives is constructing these narratives and these sources of hope and meaning to avoid the uncomfortable truth. But really it's by diving into the uncomfortable truth, there's kind of a hidden liberation in it.
Mm-hmm.
And often, often we don't realize that liberation until we experience some form of tragedy or something extremely painful. In that, you know, if our life is insignificant and short, and the vast majority of the things that we do will never matter in any major or significant form, then there really is no excuse from being exactly who we wish to be. There is no excuse for not loving people unconditionally and fiercely. There's no excuse for not taking the risks or confronting the fears that you feel. You know, it's this kind of dichotomy of like, if there's no reason to live, then there's also no reason to not live. There's no reason to ever back down from anything that intimidates us or potentially hurts us. And so in that sense, the uncomfortable truth is incredibly liberating. That ultimately, because we all depend on these narratives to generate hope for ourselves, there's also, it also empowers us, because once we become comfortable with the uncomfortable truth, we realize that we are the ones who are writing those narratives, and we can write whatever narrative we want.
Okay, wait. So once we are comfortable with the uncomfortable truth, then we realize that we're writing narratives that protect us from the uncomfortable truth.
Yeah, well, basically what we find meaningful in our lives is an arbitrary construction. You know, people assume that it's like, you know, I got to get a good job and I got to buy a nice car and I got to, you know, and I got to get married. Like, these are all the things that matter. And yes, they can matter, but people don't recognize that they are actually choosing for those things to matter. Like, that it is an active choice that is happening in the background of everything. And I think when those narratives collapse, when something horrible happens, some catastrophe happens, and all those narratives collapse, and you realize, like, oh my God, my car doesn't mean anything, and the job I thought was going to make me feel really important is actually totally pointless. You know, it's once you strip all those things away and are confronted with the uncomfortable truth, then you recognize, you're like, oh wait, I get to decide what's meaningful in my life. I get to decide what matters. And and it's kind of like discovering a bit of a superpower.
Well, yeah, because that contrast between being confronted with the uncomfortable truth with whatever it was that you thought was important the moment before you were confronted with the uncomfortable truth, that contrast can be kind of cartoonish in a way. Like, I was just, you know, I've been recalling the experience trying to find, you know, what I can learn from it and write about. And I, there were certain things that I remembered being so important, like the moment before I, you know, looked at my phone or, you know, did the phone call, such as, like, I had forgotten that I, like, decided not to eat that day. Like, I have to go to the airport right now. I'll just not eat.
Yeah.
Things like that. So I guess that contrast can help you, can cause you to see the uncomfortable truth. And I think for a lot of people, that's, I mean, I'm in some way grateful that everything was really fucked for a year before this through a different avenue, because that really put me in contact with the uncomfortable truth, that, like, I was struggling to be able to remain on the soil on which I was standing, despite the things that I had invested in trying to build a particular life. And then for a while there, that was just not going to happen. It wasn't working and stuff. And so I had to, like, I was confronted with the uncomfortable truth, and I ended up processing it in some ways so that when this happened, I felt a lot more prepared. And I can see how, when a lot of people are confronted with the uncomfortable truth, that can be incredibly destabilizing.
Well, I think it's one of those situations where it's like, you gotta, before you can build a better house, you gotta, like, break the old one down. And that's not a fun process. You know, identity change is never like, one of the things I did a speaking tour this summer, and one of the things that I was always saying is, I was like, you know, identity change is not a fun weekend seminar. It's fucking grueling, and it lasts for months, if not years. It's usually catalyzed by some, you know, horrible experience, painful experience. But one thing you mentioned, I think the experience, so when we tend to have these kind of tragic or catastrophic experiences, what we thought was important in our lives suddenly seems incredibly unimportant. And then from our new perspective, we have to build back up. We have to, like, start constructing that wall of what is meaningful to us again. You know, what most people experience this as is it's a huge and sudden shift in perspective. And it can be, depending on that shift, it can often be very healing in a lot of ways. I actually haven't told this story before, but it's my stepmother and I, like, fought pretty much my entire adolescence in early 20s. Couldn't stand each other. It was impossible. You know, sometimes we couldn't even be in the same room as each other. And she came up from a very rigid kind of military background, And I was like this hippie kid smoking pot and listening to heavy metal music. And so it was just, it's a really bad combination. And we went to family therapists. She went to counseling. I went to counseling. My dad would intervene. We had all these kind of like interventions. We tried to do trips together. Like it was, nothing worked. Nothing made it better. And it was interesting because I think around the time I was 25 or so, they found a brain tumor, and she went to the hospital, and there was about, I think like 24 or 48 hours where they didn't know if it was cancerous or not. And, it turned out it wasn't, but she still had to get brain surgery to remove it. And, uh-huh. You know, it's like, it's still fucking brain surgery. So it's terrifying and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So it had a huge, huge impact on her. And it was funny because I remember I came home that next year and she was so mellow. And I remember at one point she looked at me and she was just like, "Hey, I'm sorry for getting upset about all the things I used to get upset about." And I was like, "What?" I was like, "Where the fuck is this coming from?" And she just looked at me and she's like, "You know, for 24 hours, I thought I might die. And I realized that I have spent the last 40 years worrying about 90% of the things that I'm worrying about just don't matter." Mm-hmm. And that was actually the most beneficial thing for our relationship.
What's that do to you? I mean, what did you experience when, you know, it seemed like she might die or when she said that? Did that change your perspective?
So this is gonna sound pretty cold and harsh, but I was surprised how much I didn't care.
Uh-huh.
And I think she knew that. I think that kind of affected her. I know it really affected my dad was really upset because he could tell that I didn't.
Hmm.
I mean, I cared a little bit, but it wasn't like I wasn't calling every day being like, "Oh, you know, how is she? Blah, blah, blah." Like I surprised myself in how, and it made me realize that I never really had a relationship with her, up until that point, even though we'd lived together and been family for like 10 years. And I think I haven't talked to her about this explicitly, but I imagine, you know, she kind of had the same realization of like, you know, her stepkids aren't calling and asking how she is. Mm-hmm. Like that says something. I think it's those experiences when you come close to death, it really shows you reality very quickly. Like one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing in my work is showing how our minds are kind of always deluding ourselves. You know, we're always being biased and prejudiced and, mm-hmm. Buying into false narratives about ourselves and the world to make ourselves feel better. And I think the confrontation with death or mortality or the uncomfortable truth is the quickest way to cut through all that.
Well, do you have any theories about why you didn't care about whether your stepmother was potentially dying or not?
Like I said, I don't, she was like a stranger to me. You know, it felt to me the same way as if, you know, one of my dad's golf buddies was dying.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh man, that's sad.
She kind of came into your family and was taking on this role that you hadn't really processed or put her in.
There was no intimacy. There was no intimacy.
Yeah.
You know, I think her idea of parenting was you create the rules and the kid follows. And, you know, we weren't family. I was like 15 when she married my dad, or no, 16 or 17. Mm-hmm. So, it, you know, I didn't grow up with her. She's just this woman who showed up and started telling me what to do. And I'm like, "Who the fuck are you?"
Yeah.
I was like, "What gives you a right?" And so I don't think we actually had a relationship.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was all very just formal surface level stuff. And so for me, that was eye-opening, was that I realized, I'm like, I don't think I have a relationship with her. Like, I don't think I've actually, you know. Mm-hmm. So I guess to answer your question, how it affected me is it kind of forced the same thing out of me. Like, it cut through my bullshit too, of like, oh, you know, this really wasn't a family relationship.
Oh.
Because if it was, I would care a lot more.
Yeah. Well, now back to this house metaphor, you know, when something happens and somebody's confronted with the uncomfortable truth and they realize, I guess it's like if they realize that their house was built on the wrong foundation and now it's like sagging on the edges and it's about ready to collapse or something. And so when they get confronted with the uncomfortable truth, they may realize like, oh, this foundation is completely wrong. I need to like tear it down, make a new foundation and rebuild the entire house on top of it. I mean, I've experienced that in my life. I think it was, you know, college, like going on a study abroad and like and realizing that my Nebraska suburban upbringing was just this total construct where I had a constructed reality for me. And now I realize, oh, that's actually not reality. There can be a completely different version of reality. And so now I need to go back to the foundation and start over. And I can see this taking an extremely long time. And, you know, that was 20 years ago. So,
yeah, right.
Or almost 20 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I've lived abroad. I've been an expat for a while. I'm in Brazil right now. Like I travel quite a bit. And I think that is actually what, I think that's probably like the highest value of travel itself, is getting out of your own bubble, getting out of your own constructs, and realizing that the world and humanity can really function and with a completely different set of values and norms to your own.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one of the things I wrote on my site about my travels is I said that, you know, often what I thought was universal, I discovered was particular to the United States. And things that I thought were particular to the United States, I often discovered were universal. And so I think it's that too is another way of kind of deconstructing these constructs of meaning or these constructs of hope. And evaluating them, asking yourself, like, is this going to hold up over the long term? Like, is this a sturdy foundation? Is this wall going to collapse?
Mm-hmm.
Because most of us, well, none of us get it right the first time. You know, we need to renovate ourselves periodically throughout our lives.
We're going to take a quick break.
I'm LR Laggy, and I'm the founder of Off Grid Mindfulness.
What about some of these other features on the Awake Mindfulness Clock? I was surprised to see this warm-up feature and the interval phases feature. Can you talk about those?
For me, it's really important to know that the timer is on so that when I'm 5 minutes into my meditation, I'm not wondering, did I turn my timer on? And so I start the timer and I place it down and I get settled on my cushion. And after 20 seconds, the chime sounds. And that lets me know that the timer is actually on.
I also really like the interval phases because every once in a while, I like to do an extremely long session.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do an hour and a half. So I like to break that up into 3 30-minute sessions
mm-hmm.
and actually find that those guideposts give me an opportunity to assess, okay, how have I done so far and to get back into the meditation.
Oh, that's great. You're the first person I've talked to who's using the intervals, actually.
Get 10% off the Awake Mindfulness Clock when you use the code LOVEYOURWORK at offgridmindfulness.com. Purchase by December 16th and get a free travel case. You know that the best talent is never looking for a job. So how do you get your job post in front of the best talent if they aren't looking? You go somewhere, they're already spending time. You know LinkedIn is a hot social platform for professionals. You heard Robbie Abed talking about it in a recent episode. So what if you could get your job openings in front of the best professionals who are already spending time on LinkedIn? You can do exactly that with LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has the deepest, most up-to-date, and insightful data set on professionals. They use that data to match your job opening to qualified professionals, many of whom aren't even actively looking for a new job. LinkedIn will promote your job opening across their platform, targeting the professionals who are the best fit for that job. I think it's brilliant because the best talent isn't actively looking for a job, yet LinkedIn is still able to reach them. Find the right person meant for your business today with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want and the first $50 is on them. Just visit linkedin.com/loveyourwork. Again, that's linkedin.com/loveyourwork to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. I think we might have touched on this in our previous conversation about, I mean, I've experienced something similar with travel, and part of it sometimes is myself, is what do I think my character traits are, and then I find myself in some other place, and I realize, oh, those aren't necessarily my character traits, because I can see that in this environment, I'm different.
Yeah.
And then maybe I'll go back to my original environment, and I'll try to hold on to, okay, let's hold on to this version of myself that I was in this other place. And slowly over time, the original environment takes me right back there. And now whether that's it causing it, or it's, you know, it's just sort of getting back into existing grooves, etc., that process over and over again, eventually you kind of polish the rock, and eventually you do start to approach some kind of a pure sense of who am I, and to what degree is my perception of myself actually a product of my environment? Is that something that you've experienced?
Absolutely. And it's helpful. I think travel is very useful for experiencing contrasts. You know, it's going from maybe a highly organized culture to a highly disorganized culture, and a culture that's is not very emotive to a culture that's extremely emotive, and one that's very ambitious to one that's not it. You know, you start to, I think what a lot of people experience as quote unquote finding themselves is really just what you just described is putting themselves in contrasting contexts that show them, oh wait, I thought I was lazy, and it turns out like this is more how I see the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a certain comfort that comes with that. To know things about yourself that aren't contingent on like the people around you or the systems around you. Like there's definitely a degree of like comfort that comes with discovering those things.
Right. Yes. And I mean, that's something that I experience, you know, just with my own upbringing. There might be certain things that I have learned about myself over the years. And then I get back into the family environment and I see somebody do something, I'm like, okay, that's where that came from. And you know, because I have been through it, it's like now I can step back and prevent it from sucking me into that behavior or that pattern again.
Yeah.
Huh. And so you said an important word, values. And so it sounds like when the house is destroyed, when you realize that the foundation doesn't work anymore, you've got to build a new foundation. Is that foundation values? And if so, where do most people go wrong? Instead of values, what are they building the foundation on?
Well, I would say I would describe the whole house as a set of values, or a interlocking system of values.
Okay.
And generally when we experience and the aggregate of those values is kind of what we experience as our quote unquote self. So to bring that a little bit more down to earth, like it's generally when we experience something that is incredibly stressful, or I guess what you'd call like an identity crisis, it's when one of our fundamental values fails us. So, you know, like just to use a really, really simple example, like let's say a person's one of their biggest, most important values is financial success, making a bunch of money, becoming rich. Generally, what people who have that value, generally what happens is around 40 or 50 years old, they get everything they want and then they freak out because they realize that it's not that once they have it, it's now unavoidable the fact that it's not nearly as valuable or important as they thought it was. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like a wall in a house collapsing, like everything else kind of tilts over. because a lot of their friendships were probably based on the shared value of financial success. A lot of their work habits and productivity habits were based on financial success, the way they, their relationship with their children, their relationship with their community, their political beliefs, like all these things are interlocked with that fundamental value of financial success. So when that value fails them, when it's no longer making them happy or it starts to actually hurt them and cause more pain in their life, it calls into question kind of everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have an identity crisis. I think experiencing great loss like you did can do the same thing. You know, it's a lot of times like having a very important relationship in our life. A lot of people go through a similar type of identity crisis through a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this relationship that they valued more than anything in their life suddenly is lost and taken away from them. It's like a central support in their house is ripped out, you know, floors collapse and walls cave in. And it suddenly all these things you thought you cared about, all these friendships and work relationships that you thought were so important. It's like you take the marriage out of the equation and it's like, oh, actually, I don't really care about these people. I don't really want to be doing this. And so that is what the process that has to happen is once you lose that value, you have to go in search of a new source of meaning or a new value to replace it. And to do that is you have to go find something else that feels meaningful in the face of the uncomfortable truth. You know, basically this question of like, if you're going to die soon, what is worth doing? And that's hard. It takes a long time. It takes a lot of trial and error. I think everybody who's gone through a little bit of an identity crisis can kind of relate to the experience of like, you go through a little bit of a phase where you do some embarrassing things and, cause you're basically what you're doing, you're trying on new values. You're trying on new identities to see if they fit. And most of them won't. And some of them will fit for a few months, but then they stop fitting, and then eventually you hit across some that fit for good, and you rebuild that wall, and you rebuild that support, and you put everything back together, and and then you wait for the next collapse.
Wow. Well, so that's interesting about the idea of losing somebody who's close to you and them being this sort of supporting element in your life that causes the whole house to collapse. Like, it feels like there's something to be balanced there because on one hand, like, that's the cost of loving somebody, perhaps, is that, I don't know to what degree it's healthy, you depend upon them being in your life in some degree. And if you were to not allow that, then you might just be so independent that you're just not open to love, etc. So,
yeah.
Did you see what I'm saying? Is there kind of like a balance in there, and what's the architecture of that?
I mean, unfortunately, it just appears that the way we evolved and are wired is that we really need somebody or some small group of people in our lives that we are emotionally dependent on to some degree.
Yeah. People who need people are the luckiest people in the world. Is that it?
and unfortunately, you know, I think we experience love and intimacy in proportion to the potential for loss. So if you never want to get hurt, you're just never going to get close to anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, the to be close to somebody, to emotionally kind of loan out part of your happiness and your sense of well-being, your mental health to somebody else, there's always that possibility of failure and loss and tragedy and grieving, I guess, is the what emerges when you do lose that person. But the interesting thing is, I mean, pretty much all the psychological research on intimate relationships, familial relationships, even things like long-term friendships, that process of kind of loaning out a piece of your mental and emotional well-being to somebody else, somehow increases it. You know, it's like It gives your life more sense of meaning, more happiness, more energy. It makes you healthier. And this is it's just indisputable. So it's, you know, we're a social species. We evolved depending on people around us, particularly familial relationships, but also romantic relationships and lifelong friendships. And so it's you need those things in your house, for it to be sturdy. Like it's kind of like trying to have an identity without close personal relationships. It's like having a house with no interior. You know, it's just empty inside.
But
and
can that go too far? You know, like this is going to make me sound cold now, but yeah. You know, I lost my mother. I loved my mother very much, but I hear other people who lose a parent sometimes and they're like, oh, she was my best friend. I talk to her every day and I always want to turn to her for advice. And I'm thinking like, you're 40 years old. Like, did you not, you still want advice from your mom? Like, I don't know. I just feel like you should be a little smarter than that. Not that your mom's like not smart, but like by now, like, haven't you reached a point where you're able to deal with things a bit on your own? And maybe there's some things that you aren't talking to mom about because she's not going to understand or she hasn't had that experience. And if she did have an experience, it was like, you know, with these values from 50 years ago, et cetera. And I kind of can't help but kind of think like, well, I don't know. Isn't that going a little too far? And is there a codependency going on there, or what is that? Can that go too far?
Totally.
Or am I just a cold jerk?
No. It can absolutely go too far. And I think our house metaphor is going to finally run out here. Because the only way I can think of keeping it going is to say that like what you're describing is like it's okay. Instead of building my house, I'm just going to move into somebody else's, and that doesn't work. Like,
yeah, move into somebody else's house. Yeah,
yeah. there's a fine balance between having your own individual identity that includes loving relationships with other people and basically sacrificing your individual identity for another person and like living vicariously through that person. Mm-hmm. And that's what's generally referred to as codependency. And it happens all the time and it's destructive for relationships. Like it's a relationship requires two healthy individual identities who mutually agree to share with each other their lives. When you get a situation where one or both people are using the other person to avoid living their own life, then it's no bueno.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's good to have your life built upon values rather than, I don't know, but just you talk about the, I guess there was the clown car metaphor of just letting your emotions drive you all the time rather than your thoughts. Or how does that tie in with the idea of building your life or your foundation or your house with values?
I think, you know, values can fall under a number of different categories. And I think I would describe them like this. You know, the first thing that we all value, and when I say value, what I mean is basically anything that gives our lives like a sense of meaning, that seems important, that seems worth doing, before we die. And let's just, like, for the sake of brevity, let's carve up values in the three different categories. First one is just feelings, feeling good, essentially. Is feeling good is kind of the value that we all start out with and we never lose. You know, it's like little infants and little kids, all of their decision making is based purely on, I want to do what's going to make me feel good and avoid what's going to make me feel bad. And what happens as we start to grow up is that we realize that life's not simple. You know, like the example I use in the book is like, you know, a little kid will know that ice cream feels good. And so the little kid will value ice cream. But at some point, the child discovers that, well, if I just go and eat ice cream whenever I feel like it, I feel sick, my mom gets mad at me, I get punished. And so bad things also happen. And so eventually what we kind of realize is that we have to kind of negotiate our values with the world. We have to understand that, like, you know, just because something feels good for me doesn't mean I can go out and do it. Mm. I have to pay attention to other people. I have to pay attention to, you know, rules and expectations in society. And I have to think about and care about the other people and things that are affected by the thing I care about. And so I think the second kind of category of values is like just people or things. And then from there, we eventually start to realize that, okay, I really value this person and I really value, you know, playing football or being good at math. But these things too are also complicated. You know, I value this person, but they lie a lot. They are mean to other people. And so I don't know if I should value that person. And so eventually, like, kind of the broadest category of things to value or care about, I describe in the book as like abstract principles, things like honesty, integrity, charity, ambition, et cetera, et cetera. They're principles because they can exist in any number of kind of like material manifestations. And so what I argue is that kind of the path, the trajectory that we're all on throughout our lives is we start, you know, our biology kind of programs into us, okay, you're going to value feeling good and whoever the people and things are that make you feel good. But to kind of grow and develop and become a more stable, healthier, and better person, we have to start adopting principles and virtues, and through reason and, you know, being critical of ourselves and reconsidering our actions and, you know, and slowly we hopefully throughout our lives and in our adulthood, we arrive at a few central principles that define us, define what we care about, what we find important in the world, and then a few pursuits and people that we believe can, you know, come along with us on the ride to get there.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. And if it goes well, this is something that stuck out to me because I've talked about anti-fragility, living an anti-fragile life on the show. Was it, yep, said truly adult values are anti-fragile. Anti-fragile.
Yes.
The more terrifying the world is, the more important it is to summon up the courage to face it. So it sounds to me that it's like, you know, it's not probably not the easiest thing to do and you can't necessarily do it overnight, but if things are going well, you'll have anti-fragile values, and those are values such that when something terrible happens and you know certain things are going to happen in your life, that you're able to cope with that experience in a way where and it sounds trite, the whole like what doesn't kill you makes you stronger thing. And it's also, you know, a terrible way to look at terrible things, because terrible things are terrible things, but ultimately you do have to continue on.
Yeah. And terrible things are inevitable. Think of it this way. Like if you are kind of stuck at like a childish level of just valuing what feels good, you know, feeling good is, it's a highly fragile value. It's easy. Like if you've built your house out of things that feel good, that is a house that's going to collapse over and over and over again. Similarly, if you've built your house out of kind of what I call conditional principles or conditional pursuits, you know, things like getting rich or buying a nice boat or like whatever, you know, that too is going to be fragile. You know, economy takes a nosedive and it's like suddenly your house is, you have half a house left. So it's really these higher abstract principles or what, you know, the Greeks and Romans referred to as virtues that are not only incredibly resilient to the changes in the world, but they are anti-fragile. You know, I think one of the things I talk about in the book is that, you know, the difference between a healthy and unhealthy relationship or like a loving and unloving relationship is what happens when there's a crisis. You know, like if you go through an awful divorce and your best friend stops calling you back, you know, like that wasn't a good relationship. Yeah. That was a very conditional relationship. But it's like if you go through some awful experience and your best friend is like calling you every day being like, hey man, you all right? You want to get a beer? You know, crises bring good relationships closer together and they push bad relationships further apart.
Yeah.
And so again, it kind of comes back and you probably experienced that. Like the tragedy of your mother's death probably reconfigured some of the relationships in your life.
Yes, definitely. Thinking about that right now, yes.
Some people weren't as close to you as you thought they were, and other people were much closer to you than you thought they were.
But at the same time, though, it's like some people kind of disappear and you can't really blame them for it in a way because,
yeah,
you know, I feel like I did the same thing because I didn't understand. I couldn't, you know, relate. There's certain ways that I've handled things in the past that I can look back on and be like, oh, you know, I could have done a lot better, but I also didn't really know any different. And so sometimes if somebody kind of disappears or something, you got to think like, well, they haven't been through something similar. So what can you do? Just give them some time.
Yeah, that's certainly true about death, I think. I think people who haven't experienced it themselves don't really know how to react when other people are going through it.
So there's so much more that we could talk about. You know, why is it that people see things as fucked when they actually aren't fucked? There's so many interesting things in the book. We could talk for much longer. I think everybody should get the book, Everything is Fucked, A Book About Hope. It's another great book by you. I loved Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck as well. And I'm so glad to have you on the show. Anywhere else where you would like for people to get more of you, Mark Manson?
Check out my website, markmanson.net. Bunch of articles there and some cool stuff. But yeah, just check out the books. And I appreciate you having me back on. It was a cool discussion. I know it was very personal for you, which is, for me, honestly, it's a breath of fresh air to have kind of more of a personal conversation like this. So I appreciate you including me on that.
Well, it came at the perfect time for me. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Is Love Your Work helping you find your unique creative voice? Does it bring you the inspiration and motivation you need to become the creator and human you want to be? If so, please be a part of making this a special and nourishing and thoughtful show. Support the show on Patreon. You'll be an even bigger part of the show than you already are. If you contribute just a coffee a month, you'll be helping support the hosting and production of Love Your Work. Everyone has some unique creative gift to offer the world. Together, we can give people the tools they need to bring that work into the world. The world will be better off for it. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/Kadavy. This is a different kind of model for supporting the work that you love. The choice is yours. Vote with your dollars, put your money where your mind is, and keep Love Your Work going. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/Kadavy. As a thank you, you'll get early access, bonus content, and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at patreon.com/Kadavy. That's patreon.com/ K-A, D as in David, A, V as in Victor, Y. And if you can't support the show financially, and you've listened to at least 3 episodes, can you do me a favor? write a review on Apple Podcasts. You can consider it your donation to help support the show. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by our top Patreon supporters, such as Jeffrey Mason. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for this show is At Sea by Durena from the album About Everything and More by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.